ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
यत् सेवया चरण पद्म पवित्र रेणुम् सद्यक्षताखिलमलम् प्रतिलब्धशीलम् न श्रीर्विरक्तमपि माम् विजहाति यस्याः प्रेक्षालवार्थलितरे नियमान् वहन्ति The Lord continued, because I am the servitor of my devotees, my lotus feet have become so sacred that they immediately wipe out all sin, and I have acquired such a disposition that the goddess of fortune does not leave me, even though I have no attachment for her, and others praise her beauty and observe sacred vows to secure from her even a slight favor. Purport. The relationship between the Lord and his devotee is transcendentally beautiful. As the devotee thinks that it is due to being a devotee of the Lord that he is elevated in all good qualities, so the Lord also thinks that it is because of his devotion to the servitor that all his transcendental glories have increased. In other words, as the devotee is always anxious to render service to the Lord, so the Lord is ever anxious to render service to the devotee. The Lord admits herein that although he certainly has the quality that anyone who receives a slight particle of the dust of his lotus feet becomes at once a great personality, this greatness is due to his affection for his devotee. It is because of this affection that the goddess of fortune does not leave him, and that not only one but many thousands of goddesses of fortune engage in his service. In the material world, simply to get a little favor from the goddess of fortune, people observe many rigid regulations of austerity and penance. The Lord cannot tolerate any inconvenience on the part of the devotee. He is therefore famous as Bhakta Vatsala. Doesn't sound very nice, does it? They're all serving him and he has no attachment to them. He has attachment to them, but not for the reason that others have attachment to the goddess of fortune, to Shri. Shri means beauty, opulence, Lakshmi Devi. Ultimately, Shri means Shri Radha. But others are attached to her for what they can get from her, because they think if she's the goddess of fortune, then I can get some fortune from worshipping her. But they don't know that by worshipping her without Narayana, they're not actually worshipping Lakshmi. You see, people keep these pictures of the Nava Lakshmi, Dhana Lakshmi, Dhanya Lakshmi, Gaja Lakshmi, and so many forms of Lakshmi. But there's no Narayana in the picture. So actually, when the conception of Lakshmi without Narayan is illusory, they're actually, although theoretically approaching Lakshmi, they're approaching her external manifestation, because she's always on the chest of Lord Vishnu. So that she is Shakti, Shakti Tattva. This has to be understood very carefully, all the different energies of the Lord. By not understanding them, then we get in trouble. We get in this material world. In this material world, people, the Shaktas, they consider Shakti as supreme. They consider Durga supreme. But they don't know that she is a Shakti. She is dependent on the Shaktiman. So although they appear to be theistic, they're not really theistic because they misunderstand who God is, who Bhagavan is. And they've even made some bogus book called the Devi Purana, or Devi Bhagavat, in which they take all the stories from Srimad Bhagavatam and put Devi as supreme, or is the cell phone supreme, that he's very busily playing with. Better don't play with the cell phone in class. You're hearing and playing with the cell phone at the same time. Well, I don't accept that, but as you're too puffed up to accept what I say, then you'll just go on playing with your cell phone. And you won't get Krishna. So they make the stories as if Vishnu is dependent on Devi, as if she is the source of everything. Of course, there's a big problem with the Devi Bhagavat. I mean, just the very name, because Bhagavat is a male term and Devi is female. So it should be Devi Bhagavati or something like that. But they're Devi Bhagavata. The actual Vedic conclusion given by Vyasadeva is that she is dependent on him, which appears to contradict the statement here. Throughout the whole Shastra, various people, they go through stages of worshipping different demigods, and then Bahunam Janmanamante Gyanabhang Vangpapajite. Once they stop worshipping demigods, and then they go on the Gyana Marga to get knowledge that we are not the body, we don't belong in this material world, but they have no knowledge of the spiritual world, and they go on the Jnana Marga, and then they finally Bahunam Janmanamante Jnanavanam Prapadite Vasudeva Sarvamiti Samahatma Sudurlava. They finally come to the stage of realizing that Vasudeva is all in all. He is supreme. But here in this verse, Bhagavan Vasudev Narayan states that, yeah, I am pretty great, but that's only because of my devotees, because I'm attached to them. Lakshmi Devi doesn't leave me. I got that good fortune of having the goddess of fortune always with me, because I'm attached to my devotees, so they are great. So what is correct? Bhagavan himself says, my devotees are greater than me. Mad bhakta puja bhyadika, when he's describing to Uddhava the process of archan, he says that worshipping my devotees is greater than worshipping myself. So what's what? Who's who? Well, from the consideration of tattva-gyan, Lord Vishnu is the param tattva. Matah parataram nanyat kinchid asti dhananjaya. When he states in Bhagavad Gita, no one is superior to me, that is true. And when he states here in Srimad Bhagavatam that my devotees are superior to me, that's also true. But they're both true, but from different perspectives. From the point of view of tattva, who's who, what's what, he's most powerful. He is the aham sarvasya prabhavaha. He is the source of everything. Everything is dependent upon him. That's a fact. But from the perspective of rasagyan, what are devotional mellows, then Bhagavan is dependent on his devotee. Tachinvatam rasagyanam swadu swadu pade pade. Srimad Bhagavatam is especially meant for hearing and then acquiring rasagya, knowledge of rasa, which we can taste at every step very happily. Therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam is the topmost shastra. It begins with the statement establishing very clearly that Krishna is supreme. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya satyam param dhimahi janmadyasya yataha. All the statements of the first verse of Bhagavatam establish very clearly that Vasudev is supreme. That is reiterated in the third chapter in the line Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna is the original form of Godhead. And that is shown throughout the Bhagavatam, how the different forms of the Lord, here we're being described, Narayan Murti in Vaikuntha, and various forms of the Lord who manifest within this world from time to time. Ramadi Murti Shukala Niyamena Tishtanna Navatara Makarod Bhuvaneshu Kintu Krishna Swayam Samabhavat Paramapumanyo Govindamadi Purusham Tamaham Majami. Ram, Nrsimha, Varaha, Kurma, Matsya, Vamana, these are various forms of the Lord who manifest within this world from time to time. But the Srimad Bhagavatam establishes Krishna as the original form. So we find that Krishna, he's dependent on his devotees. And not only in his Krishna form, in other forms also. In this same Vaikuntha Narayana, he tells the same thing to Durvasa Muni. Aham bhakta paradhino nahi asvatantra. That I'm dependent on my devotees. I'm not independent. So at the beginning of Bhagavatam, it's established he's independent. Swarat, in the very first verse. But later on he says, I'm not independent. So again, it's from different perspectives. From the perspective of Tattva, certainly Vishnu is supreme, but his own energy, his bhakti shakti, is out of his control. He becomes subordinate to that. And out of love, he becomes subdued by his devotees. So that same Krishna who expanded himself into so many forms, Brahma saw so many forms of Vishnu expanded from Krishna as cowherd boys and calves, and that same Krishna is tied up by Mother Yashoda. Brahma had a doubt when he saw this little boy running in the forest with no shoes on, taking a picnic, and his friends are stealing his lunch box and eating some yogurt, curd rice. Krishna likes that. It's a famous preparation in South India. It describes Krishna's eating that. And it's dripping down through his fingers and he's in left hand. Not very cultured. Vaishya class. What do you expect from Vaishyas? Not very cultured. So Brahma had a doubt. How can this be Bhagavan? And then he saw later, a moment later or a year later, depends whether you're Brahma or whether you're one of us. Then he saw that the calves and cowherd boys are expanded forms of Vishnu. So that same Vishnu who's all powerful is subordinate to his devotees so that he lets them steal his lunchbox, climb on his back, defeat him in wrestling, tie him up, and so on. So this is the paradox. That is the beauty of bhakti. Srila Prabhupada uses this word in the beautiful in the first line of the purport. The relationship between the Lord and his devotee is transcendentally beautiful. This word beautiful is popular with superficial people. They like to use the word beautiful. Everything's beautiful, 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 amazing, wonderful. They use the word like 10 times in every sentence. But if applied to Krishna, then that's applicable. Otherwise, beautiful, now what's beautiful? All these bogus Not all of them, some of them bogus gurus. Wonderful, beautiful. But they don't know who is actually wonderful and beautiful. That is Krishna. The word beautiful is there, but it's insufficient to describe Krishna. But still, some word has to be used. That has to be qualified. Yang Shamasundaram Achintya Guna Swarupa. His form is blackish and very beautiful, decorated with transcendental, inconceivable qualities. Some attempt is made to describe him. Venam kvadantam aravinda dala yataksham. He's playing the flute, and his eyes are like newly blossoming lotus buds. Parhavatamsam. His peacock feather in his hair. Asitambuddha Sundaranga, the Sundar Sundarya, his beauty is qualified, it's described. His body is just, his bodily form is just like a black cloud, beautiful black cloud. Then young Shamasan, yes, he's very beautiful like this. So beautiful, it's a word, it's thrown around loosely by superficial people. But actually the term is applicable to Krishna and everything in relationship with Krishna. Even Nrisimhadev looks very beautiful with the intestines of Hiranyakashipu draped around his mane and blood spattered all over him. A lion becomes more beautiful like that. The beauty of a lion is his power. It's a very sleek form. It's a beautiful form of a lion, but the lionness of a lion is not just his looks, but what can he do? He can rip to pieces. So he rips to pieces Hiranyakashipu and looks very beautiful for doing so. Varahadev. We can't imagine how a hog can look beautiful, but this is a very beautiful form. All the forms of the Lord are very beautiful. Even more beautiful is the relationship between the Lord and his devotee, which is being described here. The word beautiful, it's a generic term, but it's insufficient to describe. Words fail to describe. The Shastra is there to describe qualities of Bhagavan and his devotees. And some attempt is there. But ultimately, the sweetness of the relationship between the Lord and his devotees is indescribable. Even in this material world, words, they only go so far. So that's why that example is given, that we can attempt to describe the sweetness of honey, but to really understand it, you have to taste it. So I can say, oh, this honey is so sweet, and so tasty. Doesn't really, conveys to the person who's hearing it that it is something relishable, but how it is relishable, what is that sweetness that has to be personally tasted by him to experience. So Shastra points us toward Krishna. Of course, this Srimad Bhagavatam especially is non-different from Krishna. So we can directly and indirectly experience tachinvatam rasagyanam swadu swadu pade pade. By hearing, we attain rasagyana, and also at every step we taste it. So directly, indirectly, vicariously, we, by hearing about devotees, we become, we get in the same mood, even in this material world. If you hear a story about some anything, then if it's a well-told story, then you, the reader or someone who's watching a movie, they feel emotions. That is the purpose of poetry. Rupa Goswami says, "What is the use of poetry unless it makes your head spin? It's like an arrow. What's the use unless it enters your heart and completely makes you spin around?" So in the same way, what is the use of poetry? Poetry has to arouse the consciousness. So even in the even mundane poetry or art, that is meant to stimulate some thought or feeling or emotion. So Srimad Bhagavatam stimulates the thoughts and feelings and emotions about Krishna, who is the actual object of all art. As the poets uselessly describing this material world, wasting their time, even though they may be expert poets. But if they don't describe Krishna and the relationship between Krishna and his devotees, then, as Vyasadeva has recorded quite humbly, Narad Muni's words to himself, Narad told him, "My dear Vyasadeva, you wrote so many books, but it's all Vaya Samtirtham. It's all a pilgrimage place for crows." So Vyasadeva himself admits. But then the Srimad Bhagavatam, this is worth hearing. This is actual poetry. This is the actual subject to hear about. Otherwise, people have so many topics for discussing. Shota Vyadini Rajendra Nirnang Santi Sahasrashah Apashitam Atma Tattvam Griheshu Grihamedhinam. Without knowing Atma Tattva, the people are discussing so many things. They go on discussing so many, all useless things without knowing what is Atma Tattva. What is the, who is the Supreme Lord? What is our relationship with Him? Without inquiring into that, then life is spoiled. Parabhavastavad abodajata yavanna jigyasata atma tattvam. As long as one does not inquire into atma tattva, then the purpose of human life is it's spoiled. One's actual thinking capacity never awakened. Abodajata. You never really thought about the thing that we're supposed to think about. We're discussing why, what, who, where, how, which way, so many questions. But what is the actual purpose of life? How can we attain actual happiness? Who is Bhagavan? What is our relationship with it? We're not inquiring into these things, and therefore the purpose of our life is spoiled, uselessly, living uselessly. That we had Nityananda Trayodashi, so that Lochandas Thakur says about Nityananda Prabhu that Heno avatar ja roti na hoilo lochan bale shei papi elo or gelo. That someone, as Nityananda has come, but who has not any interest in Nityananda Prabhu, what can you say about such a person? You can say he was born and he died, that's all. His whole life story. He was born and he died, and nothing of any use in between. Useless. And useful, meaningful, to understand, and that also understanding, not simply by a mental process, but by entering into the relationship between the Lord and his devotees. How this is the, yeah, it's a great paradox. How Bhagavan is anxious to, just as the devotees want to serve Krishna, so Krishna wants to serve his devotees. It seems unimaginable that how, why would the Lord want to serve his devotees? In materialistic consciousness, we think, Ishvaraham aham bhogi. I'm God, I'm the enjoyer. Everyone should serve me. I'm on top, I'm number one. But who is actually Ishvara and bhogi? Who is actually the controller and the enjoyer? Even though he is the controller and the enjoyer, and he is being served by unlimited devotees, he prefers to serve his devotees. We see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he returned from Gaya, apparently transformed from a wrangling scholar to a Vaishnava, he was very anxious to serve the devotees. He'd carry their paraphernalia for doing puja down to the Ganga, hold their cloth when they were taking, when they were bathing in the Ganga. He wanted to serve his devotees. So this is not possible to understand who, by people who only think of God in terms of his greatness. Well, they can understand that God might do something for me, but they think it's, well, I worship him, and therefore he does something for me. You have to worship him, like they consider in mundane terms. It's just like a big person of this world. You go to a minister and then you give him a bribe, or you work for his party and make sure he gets plenty of votes, and then he does something for you. You worship him and he does something for you. So they think like that about God also, that, well, you do some service to him and then you should worship God. Why? Well, then he'll help you. It's not God-centered, it's me-centered. I'll worship him and he'll do something for me. But bhakti, real bhakti, begins beyond this point of thinking, what will he do for me? It's as John Kennedy famously said, a misplaced statement, but do not think what your country can do for you. Think what you can do for your country. So his country, well, they shot him, so didn't help him much. It's what Prabhupada said about Mahatma Gandhi also, that he worked so hard for his countrymen, but then one of his countrymen shot him. So he couldn't, he was showing the impossibility of, he was a selfless worker for his country, but it was his useless selflessness, because it was not appreciated by certain people. In this material, you may try to selflessly help others, but you can't satisfy everyone. He satisfied the Pakistanis by and the Muslims, but then the certain Hindus like Nathuram Godse didn't like him enough that they thought he was better dead than alive. So in this material, we talk about selfless worker. Actually, no one can be selfless in this material world. Or even if one attempts to be selfless by trying to help, one cannot help others without pushing some, without causing harm. You can't help one person or group of people without causing harm to others. Just like the government has this policy of helping themselves to get votes by giving reservations in colleges and government jobs for the scheduled castes and scheduled tribes. But in this way they do violence, or they disadvantage other castes, the higher castes. But Bhagavan, his affection, that is amandadayada, it doesn't have any bad effect. So we think that, well, God, he can't serve anyone else, because if he serves anyone else, then that means he's less than them. His greatness is compromised. Well, actually, in one sense, it's true that the Bhagavan does become less than his devotee voluntarily. But his greatness is not compromised by doing so. His greatness is increased by doing so. There's no question of him losing his powers. Again, it's a mundane conception. We think that, well, if a king gives out his power to all the different lords, then there won't be any power left for himself. Or they'll all gang up on him and kill him. So being powerful in this material world, it's always a dangerous situation. Because you can't do everything yourself. You have to manage through others. And politics means that everyone's looking for themselves. They're looking for their own benefit. So it's very dangerous. The people who are helping you, they're the most dangerous. Because they know all your secrets. And they can do you in more easily than others. You have to trust someone, otherwise you can't do anything. But if people, they misuse that trust, they can misuse that trust to turn around and act against the person who placed the trust in them. But with Bhagawan, there's no such question. For a start, he trusts those who are trustworthy. He's a good judge. Because he knows, he's antaryami, he's in everyone's heart. And even if, as in Christian mythology, a bunch of angels gang up on God, Lucifer was the head of the rebel angels who made a faction, the heaven's version of the LTTE. They ganged up and wanted to take over. And God, you know, with great effort, threw them out. But there's no, even if, theoretically speaking, even if all, even those who gang up or go against him, they don't have any position. Then they become conditioned souls in this material world. But his shaktis are always under his control. Parasya shakti vividhaiva shruyate swabhavaki jnana balakriyacha. His shaktis, they're all within his power. There's no question of them going out of his power. Even if he appears to be tied up by Mother Yashoda, or even if he appears to be sometimes in fighting, you're reading about Varaha Dev. That during the fight, it appeared that Hiranyaksha at one point was getting the upper hand, but that's only his play. His mace was knocked down. That's only his play. He's always in full control. But he becomes controlled by his devotees. And this is the real greatness. That's why Gauriyas, they ultimately worship Radha. Radha Krishna. There's no, Gauriyas don't see any Krishna without Radha, and there's no question of Radha without Krishna. But it's difficult to say exactly, it's difficult to pin it down exactly, because Gauriyas, they see Radha as the greatest because she controls Krishna by love, and all of Vrindavan is simply centered around facilitating Radha's love for Krishna. But then, Radha and Krishna are inseparable. So, there's no question that we'll just worship Radha and forget Krishna. But in Rasavicha, some devotees, they may appear to take the side of Radha more. In Vrindavan, the topmost area of Krishna's activities, where he's really doing what he wants to do, most of all. What does he do? In Vrindavan, the loving exchanges are intense to a degree unimaginable elsewhere. There's no formality there of considering him Bhagawan. Or even if the Vrajvasis sometimes think, well, he is Bhagawan, but why is he so late for lunch? Go get him. Rohini, this Adi Yashoda sends, and she can't do it, so Yashoda has to go. And Rohini couldn't call Krishna and Balaram back, but Yashoda could, because she's got them more under control. They love her more. They're more afraid of her. So these are the ultimate topics of Srimad Bhagavatam. In discussing how great he is, how he controls the universes, these are all topics, but they are understanding all this, we will hear about Ahamiha Nandang Vande Yasya Linde Parang Brahma. We'll hear about Nanda Maharaj, this Raghupati Upadhyay composed a verse in which he says, I worship Nanda Maharaj. Why Nanda Maharaj? Because in his courtyard, the Supreme Truth is playing like a helpless little boy. Hare Krishna. Any question about this? Yeah, I said it, that everything's under the control of the Supreme Lord Krishna. And even if I didn't say it, it would be true. And even if you don't understand it, it's true. And I don't understand it either, but it's true. Then where is the question of free will? Everything is under his control, but he gives a little leeway, little independence. If you're locked in a room, you're controlled, isn't it? You can't go outside the room. That your control. But you can stand, sit, stand on your head, walk from one side of the room to the other. You're controlled. You're in a prison cell, you're controlled. But you have a little freedom what to do in there. So like that. If the prison keeper wants, he can also come in the room and tell you, hey, stop standing on your head. Stand on your feet. He can control that also if he wants to. But he gives you a little freedom. That's all. Anything else?
You use the word mythology for...
Yeah, mythology. It's pronounced in standard English. If you want to learn. In India, it's mythology. Yeah?
For Christian...
Christian mythology. Well, for the Lucifer ganging up on God... Well, I said Christian mythology because we don't accept it as being factually true. Certain Christians do, and certain others say that it's mythology. They themselves. Within Christianity, there are different schools. So some say everything in the Bible is true, which is difficult since there are great contradictions. And others say that some things are allegorical. But an Orthodox Christian would, I don't know even if it's in the Bible actually, or if it's a later, you know about that? You ever read the Bible? I don't know, I think maybe, Satan definitely makes an appearance in the New Testament. He comes and speaks to Jesus, that's there. But you see a lot of things in Christian so-called theology got introduced later. Just like they say, well, you have to be baptized and then only you can go to heaven. Then what if someone dies before their baby is born? Then they invented some place called limbo. And what if you're a Christian, but you're a sinner? So you do all bad things, so then they invented purgatory where you roast. It's like hell, you get roasted for a little time and then you go and join all the good Christians. So these are different theories. These are purgatory and limbo as invented in Catholic theology, and others, Protestants, I think they mostly don't accept that because they only accept what's in the Bible. Anyway, it's a big subject. The whole of Christianity is just a whole big myth anyway. This idea that God died for 3 days. He was killed by men. He was sentenced to death and got executed. It's practically atheism. How can they say God died? Well, what kind of God is that? It's useless. After 12 years or so, of course, from about age 5 to about 13, so after 8 years of Christian indoctrination, I had the eureka experience of understanding this is all nonsense. The all-merciful God throws you into hell forever with no hope of any redemption. What kind of jerk is that? It's useless. As far as theism is concerned, well, you could say it has some use. It gives, at least there's some acceptance of a supreme power. But the whole idea that Jesus is God himself, it's that he died. The central principle of Christianity is that Jesus is God, come in human form, and he died for our sins. It's bogus. Jesus is not directly Bhagavan. It's a very primitive theology. That people have no brains. They don't think. Hindus, Hinduism is like Christianity is like it's got one main nonsensical thing, and Hindu.